Welcome to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast for Sunday, December 20th, 2015. The Reverend Ron McHattie is preaching. The message for today is the peace of God. The Old Testament reading is Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 9, and the New Testament reading is John chapter 14, verses 25 through 29, and chapter 16, verse 33.
This has been a really interesting series for me. It'll be interesting to see how I work with it, if I ever rework it. But one of the questions I was thinking for you to just kind of think about is that question, you know, you used to have that ad, got milk, and I just kind of got peace. I mean, peace is even more elusive in some ways than that word joy that we looked at last week. And I just jotted down these thoughts, just letting my head ramble and put them on your notes. Peace is something it would appear almost everyone wants, yet it can be very evasive, and the definition of what each of us are seeking often varies. What is it that you want? Is it really what you want? Do you even have any idea of what you really want that will give you peace? Even if you did know what you really wanted, could you miss discovering peace? Could you discover peace and not even know it? I found it very interesting in the reading, and you know, it was coming all over the place. But so oftentimes there would be just at least one little paragraph on warning people to watch out for false presence of peace and how peace gets marketed to us in today's world. And then when we secure to find it or whatever, we find out it's not really giving us what we want. Hopefully we'll answer a few of those questions as we go through this morning and give you some new insights. As I was working on the message, I was thinking, how would I try to weave the four emphases of Advent, or at least as what we've used, into one sentence if I was able to do it? I mean, the first one was on faith, and then we have love, and then we have joy, and then we have peace. And so hopefully this will also make a little bit more sense as we come to the end. But I ended up writing this summary statement. The peace of God is a manifestation of God's joy to be found in the love of God through Jesus Christ, the hope of the world. So that's what I ended up as a summation line. But again, you have to understand what each one of those words mean in the context there. But that's what I wrote as my own summation of the word. Peace is a very interesting word because unlike joy, and then even more unlike the word love, peace is like many of our words in the English language. It just covers a gamut of everything. So I made this little box in there on your second page there. Peace is mentioned 420 times in Scripture, and you need to read the context, even if you're in the original languages. In the original language, peace doesn't give the people in the original languages the benefit of like love. You're not reading it, and all of a sudden you discover that there's three different words, and so you see what word is being used by the author, and you know immediately how you're zeroing in. On the word peace, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, it's real broad. It gets used in a whole bunch of different ways. And so, it's just, you don't have any, the sermon notes aren't in there? You don't have this? Well, okay. Well, some of you have them. Yeah. Huh? Use the phone. Okay, well, we'll see if it's coming. If not, we'll try. Or we'll go steal them out of the second hour ones. that's really interesting. Funny week. Anyway, it's used 430 times in Scripture. And you have to read context, whether you're in the original languages or in a contemporary translation. So in the Old Testament, almost all of us in the room, whether we're believers or not, everyone knows the word, the Old Testament word for peace almost, and that's the word shalom. And it can just, be as simple as, I hope it goes well for you, you know, trust you have a great day sort of thing, not quite that flippant. It refers to all sorts of relationships, our relationships with God, our relationships with one another. It's just this is a very broad word. It encompasses a little bit more. Most of the messages I've heard over the years on the word peace, when they start working with the word shalom, the emphasis is trying to help people understand that it can also refer to your total well-being, just not prosperity and the lack of war or the lack of tension, but also just a spiritual well-being within your life. So you can see how broad the word is. Now, when we come into the New Testament, the primary word in the New Testament is eirene, and it sort of focuses on rest and tranquility. When you read the word peace in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, it's leaning towards the shalom emphasis in the Old Testament. Paul, if you are reading through his letters, he'll greet the recipients of his letters with the words grace and peace. We'll make copies of this and try to have them to you by next Sunday for anyone. I'm sorry about that. And that's real interesting because the word peace is the Jewish greeting or the Hebrew greeting, and the word grace is the Gentile greeting. So when he uses that phrase, peace and grace, he's greeting everyone, whether you're Hebrew in your background or you're Gentile in your background. But again, it's a situation of context, but it keeps zeroing in a little bit more all the time to focus more upon something that's happening between you and God. And so I have in the notes, for those of you who have it, that peace then becomes a gift from God. So you have this all-encompassing word in the Old Testament, and then it stays all-encompassing, but as it comes into the New Testament, it gets a little bit narrower, not so much in its meaning, but in its usage, in its context, to the point that we begin talking about the peace of God. Now, that's not used very often in the Old Testament. It can be implied in some of the contexts, but as we start reading through the writings of Paul, especially Paul, it gets even narrower, trying to talk about something that's transpiring within the person themselves. And and kind of like joy, remember we said that joy last week isn't this happy word. It's a word that encompasses our understanding of our ability to stay relatively focused and not fall apart in our lives, because we have an understanding of the big picture of what God's in the business of doing in terms of trying to save as many as possible. Peace has that same kind of emphasis, except that it's more internal in a sense. It's more internalized. It's this deep, settled sense of calm that, as Paul says, defies explanation. Defies explanation. So it's even a more... it's kind of even a deeper word in a sense than joy. Joy is a big picture word, I guess you would say, and peace is a much more personal, internal kind of word. And I want to give you a couple of illustrations this morning, hopefully to help you come to terms with it. One of the things that's disturbing, though, a little bit in Jesus' teachings, especially towards the end of John, is that we have the ability to nurture or enhance our experience of God's peace. And the thing that's difficult for many people to come to terms with on that is that he associates that with our willingness to be obedient. And it's also, in the Old Testament, one of the things that disturbs me oftentimes, maybe sometime Henry and I, since it looks like I'll be sticking around a little bit longer, I shouldn't even mention this because I may be, you know, yeah, I know. You are one of the most polite, respectful people I've ever met in my entire life. And Paul has his PhD in Old Testament studies. So Paul studied the Old Testament. Henry has. but one of the things that's always disturbed me as I've listened to most pastors teach and preach on the Ten Commandments is that they again miss context. Because as you go into the Ten Commandments, what Moses is saying there is, I want you to follow these so that it might go well for you. And I go, why do we get the Ten Commandments in this context of it kind of being like a battering ram? You can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do that. Rather than this wonderful context of God saying, these are really helpful guidelines. And that's what the word really means in there, helpful guidelines, so that things might go well for you. So one of the things I like to share with kids especially is, this is like an owner's manual, like you get in for your automobile, and if you open it up and you begin reading it, the car runs better, you know? And if you read this and you begin practicing it, what do you know? Wow, we run better too. I just hate how we sometimes put it always into a negative context. But Jesus has this emphasis between obeying and experiencing God's love and knowing God's love, and in return, knowing the sense of rest and peace. It's in the back of my mind, it's kind of like a fish going with the flow of the stream and going down, or fighting their way up against the flow of the river or the stream. And a lot of us are just, you know, we're determined not just to lay back on our backs and float down the river and enjoy it as much as we want to try to swim against the current. And we pay some results. So there's that lesson of encouragement in there. And then Paul also has a strong emphasis in his writings that we have an obligation to let the peace of Christ rule in our hearts. And that's a very interesting phrase, letting the peace of Christ rule in our hearts. What does it mean to be motivated by this deep sense of security, well-being, in the context of what peace is? Peace is a really hard word. If joy is a hard word to get a handle on, peace is, because they're so personal. They're more than just an intellectual pursuit. So I want to pursue that a little bit this morning in terms of what, trying to help you understand a little bit from my perspective, the peace of God, the peace of God, the peace that passes all understanding. I had an uncle who was a World War II gunner in a B-17. And after the war was over, he stayed in the Air Force. And one of his assignments for a period of time, I don't know what his responsibilities were on the plane, but they piloted the plane for the scientists that were doing studies on hurricanes. And so he had this experience of flying into hurricanes and then flying out of them. And I remember as a young child him talking about how terrified everyone in the plane was as they flew into a hurricane, because it just felt like and sounded like they could hardly talk to one another. They were shouting to one another inside as they were barking out commands and stuff. But like the whole, everything about the plane was going to fall apart. I mean, it was just getting bounced. Nothing was stable. It was just, you know, it was like the bolts were popping out of the rivets, kind of. And then they would hit the eye of the hurricane, and it was absolute stillness. Just eerie stillness as they... And it was almost like they were kind of gliding through the eye of the hurricane. And then they had to make their way back out. And again, just feeling like the whole thing was going to get torn apart. When they would get outside of the hurricane, it would be calm, but it was nothing. He said that the eye of the hurricane was just, it was like a piece that passes, you know, is impossible to totally explain. He said it was just this eerie calm. And yet, you know, you could look out and you could see the clouds and everything else around you whirling, and you knew that wherever they were hitting landfall or whatever, they were creating horrific damage, but you were just in the midst of this amazing sense of calm. So I kind of thought, okay, so if that's an image possible of the peace of God, that is something that's deeply rooted in us in the midst of of horrific things that can go on in our life and calm. Maybe joy then is being on the outside of the hurricane and you're maybe getting buffeted by the winds and stuff like that, but you're in a perspective where you can see the total scope of it, kind of like a weatherman, you know, a person looking at all of this and seeing it. So that's kind of how I'm working with joy and peace right now as I think about that. And then, you know, finding steps towards finding peace. I think Philippians 4:4-7, jotted that at the beginning of your sermon notes. Many of you know these passages. Rejoice in the Lord always. There's that word joy again. Again, I will say rejoice. It's a command like we talked about last week. Let your gentleness or perseverance be made known to everyone. Again, joy is present in the midst of difficult times. The Lord is near. Then comes this word, do not worry about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, tossing in that word, pray. Don't be afraid to pray for what your desires and your needs are, but pray in the context of thanksgiving, remembering how God has already been at work. Let your requests be made known to God. You follow that formula, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. In a summation, that's the formula. And what I get in that formula is two things. Number one, out of my own personal experience, it encourages us to trust. It also encourages us to submit. And, you know, submission is a real negative word in our society. But if you submit to the will of someone that you know has nothing but your good intent and desire, it's relatively easy to submit to their wishes. You know, I'm pretty confident that when Jema is saying something, she's not desiring ill will for me. So even though I may not like what she's suggesting, it's easier to say, okay, you know, I'll do this. It's a hard thing to get across to our kids, but you know, it's kind of that same concept. So I'm going to do something I've never done before. Going to tell, and Jema doesn't know I'm going to do it this morning either. So we'll find out the reaction when we get home. The best way I can try to help you from my own personal experience understand the peace of God is by telling you my own personal experience with it. And this is a little bit more eye-centered than what I would like, but I think it's one of the most powerful, it's the strongest illustration I can give to you to try to give impact to this. Took me a long time to get my doctorate. I was doing great until I became a senior pastor, and then the workload just overwhelmed me, and everything kind of went on the shelf, and then Fuller got on my case because I was taking too long. Fuller had done something really stupid in the beginning when I was in my studies. They gave me the opportunity to prepay. So, you know, I prepaid for all my classes and everything. And then 6 years later, I'm not done yet, and they've increased tuition 10 times. And, you know, and I'm still going to school, as far as they're concerned, for nothing. But, you know, too bad. I've got it right here. I wrote the check, and it's mine. But now they're beginning to lean on me on my time sequence. And then the next thing that happens is that, lo and behold, I decide I want to change my emphasis. And that did not go across well at all. Oh my gosh, did they get in my face about that. So to try to discourage me from doing that, they said, the only way we'll let you change your emphasis is if you turn in all of your preliminary work and your rough draft for the original. So that's what I set out to do. And the summer before I was wrapping it all up, I just needed some peace and quiet and time to myself. So I asked during the summer if Jema and the kids could go north and be with family. When I finished, I would catch a plane and get up there. So my typical work day would be I would work all day at church. I would eat. I would do whatever meetings I had, come home, get in our little camp trailer, that I had all set up as a study, and then I would just study and work and write, and I would wake myself up the next morning at the desk, falling asleep, go in, take my shower, go back into work. So by the time I finished all of that to turn into Fuller, I was totally exhausted. And got on the airplane to fly home, and as we were getting ready to land in Seattle, and we were coming down, we were almost on the ground, and I had this massive explosion inside of my head. It was really sensational. It was the best fireworks show I had ever seen in my entire life. The negative part was, it was really painful. And when we got to the ground, I was on my knees in the plane with my head pressed against the seat in front of me, trying to counter the pain. And then I was okay, kind of walked off, and like a good husband, said nothing to my wife the whole time we were there, so I wouldn't ruin anything, but I just had this massive headache the whole time we were there. When we got back, I told Jima that I'd had this ongoing headache that had never stopped for whatever period of time we had been there. I got reprimanded and, you know, all the words. And I did my first series of rounds with the doctors. And when we got all done and going through the scans and going into the tube and all the rest of the stuff, they just put up their hands and said, we have absolute, and the headaches had finally gone away, we have no idea what took place. They had all these theories, but no conclusive stuff. So just kept on going. And that was in 1987. In 1989, I was in the process of finishing my dissertation. And again, the last summer, I asked Jamie and the kids to go up. I went into my routine. I still remember that night I finished. And when I put the last dot on this document, I wept uncontrollably in the trailer. There was just this mass of relief. This stupid sucker was finally done. And went inside the house, went to bed, and the next morning woke up and I could not move. And that was really weird. And everything on the right side of my body, from the top of my head to the tip of my feet, was like it was paralyzed. I had no range of motion. I had nothing on the right side of my body. And it was numb, like someone was relentlessly hitting my funny bone. And finally dragged myself out of bed, got my plane reservations, flew to Seattle. Again, didn't say all that much to Jama. Got back home. By then, it was just kind of there. I felt like I was dragging the right side of my body around everywhere I was going. Again, the insistence, this time I was more concerned. See the doctors. I don't know how many months I went through testing, but it was just over and over and over, the testing. And then finally get called in for the results, and my neurologist said to me, I can tell you our best guess. So this is 1989. I can tell you our best guess, but we have no firm decisions. He says, I need to take you in and show you all the x-rays and all the scans. So we went in there, showed all the x-rays, all the scans, and then he put up, he took me over and he said, I need you to look at this right here. And he said, this is your brain. And he said, you see all these white images all over your brain? And I said, yeah. And he said, all of those are lesions. And I went, okay. And he said, our best guess is, because of where they're located and how many are in your brain, you have MS. but we don't know why you're still functioning. You should not be functioning the way you are. And they said, MS is the mystery disease. We don't know how you get it. Sometimes it can disappear overnight. It comes and it goes. All we can say is you are really a lucky person to have your brain look like this and for you to be able to function like this. And we have no explanation for you at all. But you can come and see me once a month and we'll see how you're doing. And after about 8 months of that, I just said, well, I just walk in and I say the same symptoms over to you. So I'm not going to pay you $125 every time I walk in here. I'll just call you when I get worse. To this very day, even right now, and there was this great debate because of how your bodies are wired. You can be paralyzed on the top half, but not on the same side on the bottom half, or vice versa. You can't have the sensations going all the way down your body on one half, except mine did. So my wiring must be messed up. So, but everything came out to the wrong answer. And that's 1989. I haven't had a day since 1989 that I don't have tingling sensations in my head or in my fingers or in my feet. If you look real closely, I swear my right eye droops, my right side of my mouth droops. Just have all these little sensations all the time. And if I get really fatigued and this whole side of my body begins to ache, then I go to bed and I sleep for 8 or 10 hours and I get up and I'm doing fine. And they said, just don't push it. Someday you're going to push it too hard and the system's just going to break, but we can't explain it to you. What I remember is that when I walked out of that doctor's office and I walked down to where my car was and I got in my car, it wasn't even a prayer. It was just a conversation. I said, well, God, I guess this is all in your hands because I can't do tiddly squat. And all I can tell you is this amazing sense of calmness settled in on me. And it was a peace that I couldn't explain. And it has basically been there ever since. It's never gone away. The symptoms are still there. We've still had difficulties in our life. Sometimes I think people feel like maybe I don't care about situations that are going on with them, but as I interact, like the accident with our son and different things that have gone on in our life, and I sometimes wonder, am I flippant? Do I have no feelings for people and for the situations in their life? And none of that's true. All that I know is I am just settled in a way that I was never settled before. I just have this deep sense of still is the only word I can say. And this sense of I can't do a stinking thing about this. It's all in God's hands. And I have a little thing that popped in my brain a couple of months ago. I have it on my desk right now in a post note. We're all living on borrowed time. And, it may all change tomorrow. I don't know. But as I wrestle with that word joy and peace, that's the only thing I can explain. I can't explain it, but I think I have a grasp of what the joy of the Lord is, and I think I have a grasp of what the peace of the Lord is. It's just a reality of my life. So I want to close the message by us passing the peace. But I want you to pass the peace with one another more as a prayer and a pronouncement. Because we pass the peace in a biblical way, but it's more kind of like we're wishing one another well. I want you to kind of try to pass the peace of Christ to one another as a pronouncement that you're passing the unexplainable. Your desire is that the recipient of your words is going to receive the unexplainable presence of God in their life, giving them the reassurance that regardless of whatever happens, everything is okay. Okay? And then we'll move forward in the service. So let's pass the peace of Christ to one another.
You have been listening to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast. To learn more about Community Presbyterian Church and its ministries, come visit us at 2800 Georgia Street in Vallejo, California. Or visit our website, cpcvallejo.org. You can also email us at cpcvallejo@sbcglobal.net. Have a blessed day.